T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Want to put your baseball skills to the test? Then get ready to show your stuff with MLB Pitch, Hit, and Run. The official youth skills competition of Major League Baseball. Sign up for free for a chance to play your way to the Pitch, Hit, and Run finals at the 2024 World Series. Visit pitchhitrun.com today.
The Dan Bernstein Show. Weekdays 9 a.m. to noon on Sports Radio 670 The Score.
Guys want to play. There's still a season to be finished out. I still think we can play a few games and then go into the playoffs, crown a champion. Let's go. Let's play. The country needs it too, man. We need something to cheer for. We need something to get excited about. I mean, watching cornhole on ESPN, ain't it?
Mark Cuban urging that the sport comes back, and I think everybody wants sports back, but it's really hard to imagine all the big sweaty bodies breathing on each other and banging into each other and that all that happening, finding a way to somehow do that as safely as we need to. Let's talk some basketball with Vince Goodwill of Yahoo Sports, senior NBA writer on Twitter at Vince Goodwill, and on the Alpamonte Ford hotline, Alpamonte Ford in Melrose Park. Vince, what's happening, man? You good?
Yes, sir. How you doing, Dan?
I'm good. I was intrigued by the conversation that you had with your Yahoo teammates in Sirat Sohi and Chris Haynes, and all very, very smart people, by the way. You guys have a hell of an NBA staff going there. Talking about, are we paying enough attention to the 93-94 Bulls? As in The Last Dance, it's all kind of being glossed over that they were really damn good without Michael Jordan.
I don't think that they really were. I think that there was a lot of things that were at play to that team winning two fewer games than the 92-93 team. I think we tend to forget the details as time goes along. Like, if you remember that 92-93 Bulls team was going for its third straight title, and as you know, teams usually coming off of those type of playoff runs and you're keeping the same core together, you kind of ease your way into the season. You know what I'm saying? You've been playing into June 3 or 4 straight years, so you can't be ramped up all the time. So the win total doesn't matter as much to me. They didn't need home court advantage and everything else. 93-94 is a totally different thing because you're motivated. And it's a different, slightly different roster. You're tweaking things. Cool coach got there. You know, you're adding pieces. B.J. Armstrong has started to emerge a little bit. He wound up being an all-star starter. But as a whole, to me, and this is not, and I promise you guys, this is not Detroit guy. This is historian here. The Eastern Conference in the 1993-94 was historically bad. The Atlanta Hawks, those Atlanta Hawks, were the top seed in the East. And they traded Dominique Wilkins at the midseason point. He wasn't even there anymore toward the end of the year. And if you look at, like, the 94 All-Star team, just, you know, yeah, B.J. was an All-Star. Horace Grant was an All-Star. Only time those guys made it. Charles Oakley was an All-Star. You know, Mookie right. Blaylock, like, solid players, but no real juggernauts. No, you know, this isn't, you know, Hall of Famer of Hall of Famers. And sometimes you win games, you know, that you shouldn't. And I think to that degree, sometimes they won a few extra games than they shouldn't have. And that's why I kind of laugh at the whole Scottie Pippen should have been MVP thing that people like to bring up. And as my final point, if the Bulls were so much better without Michael Jordan, how come they were a 500 outfit in 94-95 before he came back?
Well, that's a strong counter argument to when you start looking at the win totals there. And I think your point's well taken about the Bulls in that last championship year knowing how to cruise and knowing when, all right, we don't have to go full bore, that when we looked at some of the minutes totals and we say, oh my God, look how hard they went after it, and Jordan would play 40 minutes a night and play all 82 games, that you're right. It wasn't load management in saying we're actually not going to play, we're going to rest. But they knew when to turn it on, when not to turn it on, when it just wasn't their night, when it wasn't worth it. That's absolutely true. That in a lot of those games, it was like, look, if we, as long as we get the seed that we need, get the situation that we need, take care of business just to get us in the best possible position to win a championship. That is absolutely the case. It wasn't the same kind of load management, but it was an understanding of marshaling their resources.
You have to be careful. When you're going for your third straight title, you are battling so much more than whatever the competition is. I mean, you look at the 93 Bulls, you look at the 98 Bulls, you see so many similarities. I don't even know if you paid as much attention to it. You're talking about a team that didn't have home court advantage in the finals because they knew they didn't necessarily need it. You know, you're going, you know you can win in any building at any point whatsoever. The 93 Bulls went down 0-2 to the Knicks. The 98 Bulls, you know, was in a dogfight with the Indiana Pacers and needed every bit of the seventh games and home court advantage to beat the Indiana Pacers. And the Pacers were not some historically great team. I don't look at the Pacers of 98 with Reggie Miller and Rick Smith and all those guys and say, man, the Bulls really went up against their equal. I don't look at the 93 Knicks and say, man, the Bulls went up against their equal. So I think we have to be careful when we're contextualizing all these different things. That's why I laughed. I genuinely laughed, Dan Bernstein, at the mere thought that someone would say that Michael Jordan would have won 8 straight titles had he not retired. Because at the end of both three-peats, he was on fumes, the franchise was on fumes, and they all needed to hit the reset button. And I know God shall strike me down for this, but Dan, Jerry Krause did a pretty damn good job in terms of retooling the Bulls around Jordan and Pippen from the end of the first three-peat to the start of the second three-peat.
I did some of the math on that last team and just looking at some statistical vectors for where things were headed. Jordan was in decline. Even yes. in that last championship, by the numbers, if we start looking at offensive rating and defensive rating, it was his worst full season. And even though some of the counting stats were really good, some of the advanced metrics were not. Pippen, after he hurt his back, was never the same. He was a shell of himself after that. You know, everybody, that whole thing was with and Rodman only played 35 NBA games after that. You know, that was toast. That was done. So it would have taken a lot of retooling. I mean, an immense amount of retooling and a whole hell of a lot of luck for that thing to have continued. I have very, very, very strong doubts. And you're right that people have baked in this idea that Jerry Krause broke up a Tatina. No, first of all, no, he didn't necessarily break it up. And we've had that confirmed by a lot of the people involved. It was over. And that's why The Last Dance felt the way it did. And the way it does in this, because it was over for a lot of reasons. It was a matter of just could they do it?
Well, you know what's funny, Dan? I feel like you've been reading my laptop because of a column that's coming out later today on Yahoo Sports. Some of those same things. Yeah, when you look at Michael Jordan, and I will say this to a degree, like he was still the best player in basketball in 1998. But Shaquille O'Neal was coming, like in terms of figuring things out in terms of maturation, in terms of being, you know, a force on both ends of the floor. He was coming. But Michael Jordan was so much greater than everybody else in all of his other MVP runs, and even in 93 and 97, where he didn't win the MVP, but was still clearly the best player in the game. By 98, you know, turning 35, you know, that means a lot. Scottie Pippen had that back injury where he never made another All-Star team. He was never the same, you know, two-way leader that Jordan would have needed him to be. You know, and Dennis Rodman, we saw that was coming off the rails a little bit too because he needed a Las Vegas trip. He was 37 years old, Dan. you know, he had turned 37. His birthday was yesterday. So, you know, that's during the 98 playoffs when you're turning 37 years old and you got torn ligaments in your hand and your body is starting to break down. He was no spring chicken. And add to the fact that Michael Jordan had, you know, he had that cigar cutter accident in the offseason of 98. So even if you come back and you have a 50-game truncated season, you have to explain to me how Michael Jordan with a severed finger, that, you know, you can't grip a ball the way that you used to, and who knows if you'll be able to play, you know, all 50 games and everything else and all these other different factors. There's an element to Jerry Krause and Jerry Reinsdorf being heroic in this, because think about how much of Chicago Bull fandom relative to LeBron James is built in by the fact that Michael Jordan was 6-0 in the NBA Finals. I would venture to tell you that Dan Bernstein, that had the Bulls made the Finals in 95 or had the Bulls made the Finals in 99 and lost to better teams, it would not have diminished their greatness at all. I don't necessarily take away from you getting to the Finals and not winning. But in today's 6-0, or you lost, or he's 3-6 in the Finals, or every other great team is lost, to some degree, their legacy is enhanced by the fact that we didn't see them fall, that we saw them broken up, and that their mystique is a little bit greater because, you know, there's a scene that I'm not sure, because I haven't seen the documentary, I haven't seen these last two episodes, where Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen are in the bowels of the Delta Center. They're yelling out 6, 6, 6, 6, and not like Delta 666, but 6 titles. And Jordan laughs and says, "You can say whatever you want, but they can't win until we quit." And he was actually right, because had they come back and played again, somebody else probably would have beat them.
We're talking with Vince Goodwill on Sports Radio 670 WSCR, The Score. And there's another report that's out that Scottie Pippen is unhappy with how he's being portrayed in The Last Dance. And I'm thinking, you know, come on, tough noogies. Anything that has improperly portrayed Scottie Pippen, and that's a bad look. When he said regarding his choice to not enter the game in that year we're talking about, he said, "It's one of those incidents where I wish it never happened, but if I had a chance to do it over again, I probably wouldn't change it." Well, why the hell wouldn't you? You know, what's wrong with saying it was a stain on my legacy, it was selfish, and I shouldn't have done it? But he says he wouldn't have changed it. Why wouldn't you change it?
Allow me to point out the hypocrisy of a Chicago sport fan. Can I do that for a second? Now, Dan, this may get you some angry phone calls later today. But,
okay.
You know, after The Last Dance, that episode, you know, I was watching ESPN. I saw, you know, Jackie McMullen talking about, you know, how Scottie Pippen should not be defined by the worst mistake of his basketball career. And a lot of the conversation was saying, you know, a lot of this was a little unfair to him and everything else. But you went on this documentary and said you wouldn't do anything differently. After all the details have been fleshed out 20 years later and everything else. Also, Scottie Pippen, understand that you weren't the last second guy. You were the team guy. You were a critical part of that franchise, but you were not the number one guy. You were not built to wear those clothes. Those clothes were built for Michael Jordan. Hence why I would contend the greatest moment of Scottie Pippen's career was, you know, pointing towards the Jumpman logo at the bottom of his shoe and telling Michael Jordan to come back. Like, that's, to me, is the greatest moment, because it's an acknowledgement that, hey, I can't do this. And here's the hypocrisy of Chicago on two levels, Dan. About 7 years ago, LeBron James had qualified for his first NBA Finals in Miami. And Scottie Pippen had the gall to go on TV and say, "I think LeBron James is better than Michael Jordan." And y'all let him slide for that. Y'all have literally let him slide for him saying something in 2011, not 2016, not this year, 2011, before the man won anything. And Chicagoans are very, very tough when it comes to forgiving their athletes. Don't we know that? Chicago is very, very difficult, Dan Bernstein, when it comes to, man, I made one mistake, one regrettable mistake, and even though I'm one of you, I'm a Chicagoan, I grew up here on the West Side, I made one mistake out of emotion, Isaiah Thomas, and you guys will never, ever forgive me. But yet, Scottie Pippen does all this, could have possibly cost you guys a shot at a fourth ring, not to mention following Hubert Davis because he overhelped on the Knicks in game 5 2 games later and cost you a game there. And you guys are also forgiving. Allow me to point out the hypocrisy there. Do you not see what I mean, Dan Bernstein?
Well, I'm not going to give you too much latitude on the Isaiah thing because I don't think
one mistake,
that
one mistake defining well, one mistake defining someone. Dan Bernstein, tell me the difference.
Yes and no. Well, at least for some of us, because I don't think it's necessarily just one mistake. You had the freezing out of Jordan in the All-Star game.
Did that really happen?
Yes. Yeah, and I've Terry Bores has the receipts on that. And he was on the show last week talking about the conversations that he heard regarding how that went down. And some of the antipathy toward Isaiah Thomas also has to do with his behavior as a Knicks executive. It has to do with some of the awful stuff that he did to the owners
Dan
of the
Bernstein,
Continental
we're talking
Basketball
about his relationship with Chicago. We're talking about his relationship with Chicago. What do you guys care about what he did with the New York Knicks? That has nothing to do with anything, and you know it.
I can speak personally, but I do think that Chicago sports fans have the bandwidth to make their decisions on whether or not they like somebody based on a totality of the body of work. And there are plenty of good reasons to not like Isaiah Thomas. And because he wasn't, it was really, and you know, Terry pointed this out too, we talked last week, the guy who should be more intensely disliked is the guy who was actually knocking Jordan out of the air every time and trying to injure him, and that's Bill Laimbeer, who doesn't seem to invoke the same antipathy from Chicago sports fans, because that's a guy who really, he could have ruined everything. He one bad landing, and, you know, we're talking about another Derrick Rose situation because this guy was so violent.
I can't necessarily disagree with you on that one. I'm just merely pointing out that Isaiah Thomas was one of Chicago's own. And if I'm talking about someone who lived in Chicago, Dan, for a number of years, watching the work that he did on the West Side of Chicago, like being on the ground with people, helping out, donating time, not donating, just being there, time, resources, money, all that type of stuff. And people are still holding on to, he didn't shake Michael Jordan's hand. Please.
I think the larger picture is people are holding on to Jordan doesn't like him much more than it is the one thing that he did. It is the fact that Jordan himself has set a tone where I think, regardless of anything, that if he and Jordan mended fences in some way, shape, or form, if they ever wanted to, that would change things. That I don't think the active thought is he led that walk off. I think it's overall people respond to the fact that he's dead to us because he's dead to Mike.
And how bad is that? Like how much like a following culture is that those two men, if they have issues with each other, that's for them to shake out. Isaiah's relationship in Chicago should stand on its own. I mean, not to get off on a tangent, because I know you didn't call me. I know we weren't here for that.
It's plain. No, it's real stuff. No, I don't care.
But to me, I feel like Chicago, his relationship with that city should stand on its own, regardless of, you know, if a rivalry is a rivalry. And I, you know, as a Detroiter, like I look pretty fondly on, you know, watching those games. Those games, you know, shaped my fandom. It shaped my perspective on wanting to be a sports writer in this business, like wanting to get behind and tell those stories. So, you know, everything about that, to me, there's a level of beauty to that. But when it's over, you know, and someone is a native of that city on the west side of that city and has done some of the best work, when you talk about, you know, the way that Chicago as a city has been perceived through the years and some of the negative labels that have been attached to people, and Isaiah Thomas has been on the ground with people doing work with the gangs, getting peace days and everything else. And people can't, quote unquote, forgive him because Michael Jordan says he doesn't like him. You got to be better. I think that's short-sighted, because if they kiss and make up and that's genuine on them, then Chicago follows suit.
I think some do. Yeah, I do. But I also think that Michael Jordan isn't the only person who dislikes Isaiah Thomas. There are a lot of people who have crossed him. There are a lot of people that he's done wrong by. Maybe he's done well in the community, but there are a lot of people throughout the game, whether in New York or in some offices somewhere, that don't have nice things to say about how he's treated people. So people are complicated. I don't think we got a, you know, it's a white hat or a black hat here, that we just have heroes and villains. I think we're dealing with complicated human beings and the outsized power that Michael Jordan remains, his brand, his
absolutely
word, you know, we're seeing it right now. This is cool. I'm glad the discussion kind of turned this way, because I didn't foresee it, but I've really, really enjoyed
I'm
it.
Sorry to hijack the whole thing.
No,
Dad.
Don't. No, don't apologize at all. No, that's genuine stuff. This is what talk radio is all about. That's what it's for. Vincent Goodwill, you think we're going to have basketball or not?
Yeah, I think so. I'll keep this short. I think they don't want to write a check back to the networks, to ESPN and Turner. I think I can foresee a possibility of the next season starting in late December, but this season finishing up as late as October.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. I hope they can do it safely, because we obviously all Absolutely. Want it back. But we'll see where this thing goes, because we're not in charge. Vinny Goodwill, thanks, man. This is really fun.
Hey, appreciate it, man. You guys take it easy.
Vincent Goodwill, Yahoo Sports, senior NBA writer. More NBA talk is straight ahead. If you miss George Karl, who's always fascinating, say whatever you want about him, but he's a thoughtful guy. And the former NBA coach joined Mully and Haw earlier today. So we're going to bring back a chunk of that next on The Score.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odyssey podcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odyssey podcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/odyssey podcast.
During the finals, we go out to dinner one night. George Karl's over on the other side having dinner. Hey, there's George Karl over there. And George Karl does not come over and speak to him.
He walked right past me. Now look at my seat. Really? Oh, so that's how you're going to play it.
You know, he just kind of went by, and I went, uh-oh, should have never done that.
I said, it's a crock of shit. You know, we went to Carolina. You know Dean Smith. You got to see him in the summer. We play golf. You going to do this? Okay, fine. That's all I needed. That's all I needed for him to do that. And it became personal with me.
Classic Michael Jordan stuff. You heard Ahmad Rashad talking about it as well. It's so funny that these invented the fact rationales for motivation. Like, he wouldn't have played hard. Like, the Bulls wouldn't have won had George Karl not done that. It's just great. But then after, like, yeah, that's what really made me want to win the NBA championship and play my best. It was that. It's all so silly. Mike Mulligan and David Haugh this morning on The Score. We're joined by that guy they described, Seattle Supersonics coach George Karl. And they started talking by asking his reaction to seeing himself in The Last Dance on ESPN and how his relationship with Jordan was portrayed.
I think we all kind of need our diversions right now. I think the pandemic has gotten us all a little bit worried, and rightfully so. And sports has gotten us, a lot of us, depressed and a little bored. And so something that happened 25 years ago, we can throw and rehash it and talk like it happened about a week ago, you know. And but Michael's great. I've always been his biggest fan. I've probably been asked 1,000 times who the best player in basketball is, and 1,000 times the answer has been Michael. And since 96, I've been with Michael, you know, half a dozen times, maybe 10 times, playing some golf and enjoying life. So, I was a little shocked that that it was that important to him in the series. But that's who Michael is. I mean, he likes to find things that elevate his intensity and his concentration. And I actually talked to our team about that before the series, that, you know, we didn't want to fraternize. We didn't want to socialize. And in a strange way, I'm the one that got caught in a kind of a no-win situation. That if I would have gone over and talked to him, he probably would have found something I said to piss him off. Or if I ignored him, that pissed him off. So, you know, I think it's something that, I think it was good. I mean, I think the documentary shows a lot of things about Michael. And one of his things is he's one of the greatest competitors ever to play the game. I mean, he is mean, angry, tough, and he does anything to win the game, not only physically, but he likes to win the game mentally too.
So that was an accurate depiction of what happened at the restaurant with you kind of giving him what was referred to as a snub. And did you know that that was going to be something that he would try to gain an edge off of?
You know, when it happened, I didn't think I snubbed him. You know, he had a group of probably 6 or 7, 8 people. I had a group of 6 or 7, 8 people. Busy restaurant. He said in the clip, or Marsh said in the clip, I walked by him. I don't remember that. And, you know, I thought about, you know, how I should handle it. You know, I was probably sitting there hoping that he would come talk to me. And, you know, so I don't know what the protocol is. Am I supposed to go to him, or is he, you know, so. I think it's funny that, you know, a lot of people have a strong opinion that I made a mistake, and other people said I did the right thing. And it's kind of one of those things that on Twitter and on social media, everybody can kind of argue about.
Now, you had Sam Perkins on that team, and you had talked to your players about not fraternizing. So you kind of had to be true to what you told the guys, right?
I think that's in a subtle way, that was the decision that I made. That, you know, it was in the back of my mind that my code would, if I would go over and, you know, socialize with Michael for whatever, 5 minutes or 15 minutes, whatever it would be, it would be breaking the code that I told my players not to do. And it would make me, I think in that moment in the playoffs, I'd rather be with my team than be in a compromised position where I'd have to explain something like that to my team.
Coach, I also found it amusing how you pointed out on Twitter this week that after we saw how Michael responded to the idea that Gary Payton could stop him or the glove, and his laughter has become sort of epic on social media. You pointed out that the last three finals games, Michael did only score average 23 points a game and shot 36% from the field. So Payton must not have done such a bad job on him after all.
Well, I think the thing that people forget is our defense in Seattle was very much oriented on switching and double teaming and scrambling and rotating. So, you know, everybody had to be ready for Michael. I mean, our defensive concepts were very much more team-oriented than one-on-one, mano-mano oriented. And so, you know, with Gary, you know, over the whole series, I think Michael shot 41%, averaged 26 or 27, which is the lowest amount of year averaged in any finals. So we did a good job on Michael. I mean, we didn't do a great job. He won the MVP. Obviously, he had his moments. The biggest moment came in game three where we lost them. But in the same sense, you know, we lost the series because their defense was better than our defense. But our defense was pretty damn good, too. And it was just two really good defensive teams going after each other at a high level. And in the end, I think it was more their defense that won their game, won the game for them, than necessarily Michael Jordan.
He's George Karl. You're listening to Mully and Haw on The Score. And Coach, I wonder if you can recall what the game plan was, what your defensive game plan against Jordan was to start that series. And you know, you played him a lot over the course of your career, and certainly you had seen him a ton and knew him very well. How do you go about defending a guy like Jordan who kind of makes a joke out of scoring?
You know, we had our double-team schemes on him. I mean, we wanted to double-team him in pick-and-rolls. We'd want to double-team him if he posts us up. But, you know, the triangle is a good spacing offense, and Michael knew how to get shots in his offense in a very positive way. I think more than anything, our scheme was to make him make jump shots, not give him free throws or layups. I think we did. I think we made him shoot a lot of jump shots, but we did foul him a little bit too much, especially in the first two or three games. But, you know, I thought he had one really big game, and that was game three, where I think he had 37. And most of the time, we actually had a couple games that he'd probably say he played average or below average.
Coach, a lot of the Last Dance focuses on the role that Jerry Krause played in the dismantling of the Bulls and also the building of the Bulls. And 2 years before the NBA Finals in 96, you, on draft night of 94, it was close to striking a deal with Jerry Krause. And apparently, as the story goes, he was hell-bent on trading Scottie Pippen to the Sonics. Sean Kemp was involved. The 11 pick was involved. I think the Bulls were eyeing Jalen Rose at the time. What do you remember about that, and how committed was Jerry Krause at that point to making a deal, and what caused it to fall apart?
He was very committed to making the deal. I went to my owner on the weekend of the draft and talked to him about the trade. And the trade could not be consummated unless the player that he wanted was going to be there. And I didn't know who that player was at the time. So I talked to my owner, and when I left on a Saturday night or a Sunday night, the agreement was that we would do the deal, that we would try to make the deal happen. But somehow along the way, you know, I've heard, you know, some radio guy got in and leaked it, and it got on the Seattle radio stations in Seattle Street. And the city of Seattle went crazy in favor of keeping Sean Kemp. They did not want to make the trade. The radio stations just blew it up. Got magnified to the point that I called Jerry back, I think, on the day of the draft, the morning of the draft, and said, hey, my owner's out. My owner doesn't want to make the trade. He's decided he wants to keep Sean, and we're done. Jerry thought I was playing a negotiating ploy. And so throughout the day, as the draft went on, he would call and say, can we get a deal? And I kept saying, Jerry, we don't have a deal. We're not going to get it done. And then he started offering money, and he started offering a better deal to us. And, you know, I didn't have the owner's ear. And we didn't have a general manager at that time. So we were kind of in a disarray a little bit from a standpoint having the power to make the deal, you know, say 5 minutes before a trade deadline. The owner had said he didn't want to trade Sean. That was the last thing I heard from him. But Jerry kept trying all the way up until about 5 minutes before the 11th pick in the draft. And I kept saying, Jerry, it's still no, we're not doing it.
Wow. That's amazing. You know, what's funny, George, is I was a beat writer covering the Bulls for the Chicago Sun-Times here for the first, you know, basically the end of the first championship, the second and the third championship, and to the year that Jordan retired. And I remember having a conversation with him one time where I was asking him who he thought was the best athlete in the NBA. And he kept saying, well, it depends on what you're looking for. But if you're looking for the guy who is the strongest and can jump the highest and probably run the fastest, it might be Sean Kemp. But there is other things that go into playing basketball. And as you watched his career, you know, he was a different player by the time he was playing you guys. He was, you know, he had all the Air Jordan stuff earlier in his career, but by the time he had come back from baseball, he was a different type of athlete. You mentioned him, you kept him with the jump shots. That's kind of how his game had evolved. I mean, he still had a really good post-up game, but he changed as a scorer as his athletic ability sort of got worse and his brain got better, if that makes any sense.
There's no question. He learned the game and he had more confidence in his basketball IQ. Instead of forcing the game, he let the game come to him. He would allow Kukoc or Pippen or Kerr or someone, if they're having a good night, he didn't need stats anymore in his career. He just let the team win. And, you know, I agree that Sean, actually, I've told people many times that in that series, I thought Sean Kemp was the best player on the court. And even though I think Michael deserved the MVP because their team won the championship, I actually thought Sean, over all six games, had more consistency and better, and I don't know about better numbers, but I thought he had more impact on the game than anybody on their court. So, as I said before, I mean, it was a defensive game. Nobody was very good offensively or spectacular offensively. And, you know, that, and I was proud of my team, how they fought back from 3-0 to make it a legit series. We scared them a little bit. But in game six, we scored 70, 75, or 78 points. You can't win on the road scoring 78 points.
Having that North Carolina connection with Michael all these years, George, how has your relationship evolved and what is it like today?
I don't see Michael very much. You know, Michael used to hang out with a lot of the North Carolina things, golf tournaments and golf. I mean, a lot of North Carolina guys get together in Pinehurst every August. I think Michael's been there a half a dozen times. And, you know, I've had the honor to play with him. And early in his career, he was a good player. Now he's a really good player, a golfer. You know, instead of those 2 years in baseball, he might have should have went on the golf circuit and see if he could play golf. But and then he might have let us, and then he might not have come back. Maybe he would be successful on the golf. But no, Michael's been a classy guy every time I've been with him. I like him a lot. I think that I'm happy the documentary is presenting him as a human and that he was the best. But his life doesn't necessarily, his life wasn't always easy. And as he said a few times, being a leader and being a leader of a championship team, there's some pain that goes with it.
The always interesting George Karl on The Score with Mully and Haw this morning. This segment is brought to you by Amco Transmissions and Total Car Care. At 8 p.m., Chicagoans come out to salute essential workers during their shift change. At 8 a.m., Amco Transmissions and Total Car Care opens to keep Chicagoans' transmissions shifting right. Call 1-800-GO-AMCO or search AAMCO for a location near you. We have the Midday Midway coming up straight ahead. I have a magazine article you cannot miss. You absolutely have to read. My jaw dropped reading this thing. I started thinking it was one thing, and then I ended up not knowing what I had been through. And I'll let you know what I'm talking about. Also, something, a reminder of something not to do when you go to Yellowstone National Park, once it opens up again. First of all, when it's closed, you shouldn't go there. But when you do go there, I'm going to tell you something not to do. That and more coming up on the Midday Midway next on The Score.
the first half or the second half. You know, it's they're two equal times.
Now, Midway.
The Midday Midway.
One, two.
Midway, the most important of the year.
Three, four.
The most exciting thing on the Midway.
Five, six, seven, eight.
Our objective is Midway.
9, 10.
You guys gotta meet me halfway out there.
So real, you can almost feel
the Midday Midway with Dan Bernstein on The Score.
We have reached the Midday Midway, and the first thing we do is recap what we did in the first half or so of our show. We had ourselves a good old-fashioned White Sox ugly cry because it was hitting home with me, you know, talking to friends of mine, lifelong White Sox fans and childhood friends of mine used to go to games with, just how miserable they are that this White Sox season isn't happening because of how excited they were. And the White Sox themselves, I'm sure, will be fine, but it just sucks. And it's so White Sox that the same fandom that had to endure the pain of 94 of losing out on that team because of the work stoppage and having a first-place team and now having everything that's going into this year with all the arrows pointed up and all the fun and all the billboards and all the new players and all the contracts and the long-term deals and all locked in, it just blows. So it's okay to commiserate. We also played back Governor Pritzker's backtrack of his unfortunate comments regarding the players negotiating. Blake Snell was vehement, if not necessarily sympathetic, in his response to not wanting to play during a pandemic. And Vincent Goodwill went some places with us, talking about the Bulls and his feelings about Scottie Pippen, Isaiah Thomas, and also replayed George Karl for you as well. A woman who illegally entered Yellowstone National Park fell into a hot spring while taking pictures and suffered burns. Yes, I would think that would happen. The woman, who was not identified, entered the national park that's closed due to the coronavirus pandemic on Tuesday. Park officials confirmed to the NBC affiliate KECI in Missoula, Montana, she was backing up to take photos when she fell into a hot spring. That is a hole where hot gases emerge near the Old Faithful geyser. Despite her burns from the fall, she drove 50 miles until being pulled over by park rangers. Then she was taken by helicopter to a hospital in eastern Idaho for treatment. The park did not provide more details. Last fall, a man who was walking off a boardwalk near Old Faithful at night also fell into a hot spring, suffering serious burns. In June of 2016, 23-year-old Colin Scott of Portland, Oregon, fell into a superheated acidic mud pot at Yellowstone and died. Colin Scott. It was said he died doing what he loved, falling into a superheated acidic mud pot. That's gotta suck. How was your day? Well, not so great. Well, what happened? Yeah, you know that superheated acidic mud pot? Fell into it. I know, right? God, that superheated acidic mud pot. You better have like a sign up on that, or like a one of those yellow like sandwich board piso mojado signs, you can do something, set something in front of it, or maybe, I mean, how, is that, are they all over the place, or do they just pop up? Because that really sucks. Yeah, well, that's, won't do that again. No, we won't. The old falling into the superheated acidic mud pot. I know we're kind of up against it here, but you absolutely must read this story. It was in the New York Times Magazine. And it is, there's a picture of a guy. And I had no idea who it was. It's sort of this odd looking man. And it's, when you look at it again, you're like, okay, he looks familiar. And then you see the title. It's a New York Times Magazine feature. And it's Val Kilmer. And it says, what happened to Val Kilmer? He's just starting to figure it out. And this, it starts out fairly straightforwardly. And we start reading it and you get into it. And all I know is my sister told me, read this. It's not what you think. And I was interested in Val Kilmer anyway and where the story goes. And then it gets, I don't want to spoil it, but it takes turns that you wouldn't believe. And the author's brilliant. And she does such a good job of telling the story in this way. And you feel like you're on mushrooms by the time this is over. There is a hallucinogenic quality to the story, to the way it's written, to the number of times you think now we're through the looking glass. Oh, wait, now we're through another looking glass on this. You've got to read the story. If you're a fan of Charlie Kaufman, the writer, he wrote Being John Malkovich, he's just from movies, Adaptation, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, and he's just got one of these brains that thinks in other creative dimensions. You've got to read this story. So it's called What Happened to Val Kilmer. He's just starting to figure it out. And the reason why he looks so strange in the picture and you don't really know who it is, I mean, it looks a little bit like Norbert Gruppe, Viggo the Carpathian from Ghostbusters 2. Somebody suggested he looks like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, but he's lost his voice due to throat cancer. Even though he insists, even though he was diagnosed with cancer and treated for cancer, he insists that whether or not one has or had cancer is only something that one can decide to think about or not. And and if you're thinking, what the hell are you talking about, Bernstein? Just trust me that we all have the time to do some of this long form reading, you will not be disappointed when you read this story. And that is our Midday Midway for today. Ian Happ is standing by. He and his buddies at the compound had all four of their respective mothers on episode 10 of the Compound podcast. And all the moms were telling interesting and embarrassing stories about their boys. And I had no idea that two of the moms are quite... I did not know that Nico Horner's mother, Dr. Keela Deal, is a professor of anthropology at Stanford University and a published author, and that Ian's own mom is a star academic, that she's an associate dean of the nursing school at Ohio State University, an author and lecturer. There were some really interesting stories, and we learned some things about these Cubs and Cubs prospects. So we'll talk some baseball and have some fun with Ian Happ. He is joining us next on The Score.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.